Talking to customers. Out of desperation, we decided to talk to some potential customers. We brought them into our office and said, "Try this new product, it's ImView." If the person was a teenager, a heavy user of IM, or a tech early adopter, he or she would engage with us. In contrast, if it was a mainstream person, the response was, "Right, so exactly what would you like me to do?" We'd get nowhere with this mainstream group. They thought ImView was too weird. So imagine a 17-year-old girl sitting down with us to look at this product. She chooses her avatar and says, "Oh, this is really fun." She's customizing the avatar, deciding how she's going to look. Then we say, "All right, it's time to download the instant messaging add-on." And she responds, "What's that?" "Well, it's this thing that interoperates with the instant messaging client." And she's looking at us and thinking, "I've never heard of that. My friends have never heard of that. Why do you want me to do that?" It required a lot of explanation. An instant messaging add-on was not a product category that existed in her mind. But since she was in the room with us, we were able to talk her into doing it. She downloads the product, and then we say, "Okay, invite one of your friends to chat." And she says, "No way." We say, "Why not?" And she says, "Well, I don't know if this thing is cool yet. You want me to risk inviting one of my friends? What are they going to think of me? If it sucks, they're going to think I suck, right?" And we say, no, it's going to be so much fun once you get the person in there. It's a social product." She looks at us, her face filled with doubt. You can see this is a deal breaker. Of course, the first time I had that experience, I said, "It's all right. It's just this one person. Send her away and get me a new one." Then the second customer comes in and says the same thing. Then the third customer comes in, and it's the same thing. You start to see patterns, and no matter how stubborn you are, there's obviously something wrong. Customers kept saying, "I want to use it by myself. I want to try it out first to see if it's really cool before I invite a friend." Our team was from the video game industry, so we understood what that meant, single-player mode. So we built a single-player version. We'd bring new customers into our office. They'd customize the avatar and download the product like before. Then they would go into single-player mode, and we'd say, "Play with your avatar and dress it up. Check out the cool moves it can do." Followed by, "Okay, you did that stuff by yourself. Now it's time to invite one of your friends." You can see what's coming. They'd say, "No way, this isn't cool." And we'd say, "Well, we told you it wasn't going to be cool. What is the point of a single-player experience for a social product?" See, we thought we should get a gold star just for listening to our customers. Except our customers still didn't like the product. They would look at us and say, "Listen, old man, you don't understand. What is the deal with this crazy business of inviting friends before I know if it's cool?" It was a total deal breaker. Out of further desperation, we introduced a feature called Chat Now that allows you to push a button and be randomly matched with somebody else anywhere in the world. The only thing you have in common is that you both push the button at the same time. All of a sudden, in our customer service tests, people were saying, "Oh, this is fun." So we'd bring them in, they'd use Chat Now, and maybe they would meet somebody they thought was cool. They'd say, "Hey, that guy was neat. I want to add him to my buddy list. Where's my buddy list?" And we'd say, "Oh no, you don't want a new buddy list. You want to use your regular AOL buddy list." Remember, this was how we planned to harness the interoperability that would lead to network effects and viral growth. Picture the customer looking at us asking, "What do you want me to do exactly?" And we'd say, "Well, just give the stranger your AIM screen name so you can put him on your buddy list." You could see their eyes go wide and they'd say, "Are you kidding me? A stranger on my AIM buddy list?" To which we'd respond, "Yes. Otherwise, you'd have to download a whole new IM client with a new buddy list." And they'd say, "Do you have any idea how many IM clients I already run?" "No. One or two, maybe." "That's how many clients each of us in the office used." To which the teenager would say, "Duh, I run 8. We had no idea how many instant messaging clients there were in the world. We had this incorrect preconception that it's a challenge to learn new software, and it's tricky to move your friends over to a new buddy list. Our customers revealed that this was nonsense. We wanted to draw diagrams on the whiteboard that showed why our strategy was brilliant, but our customers didn't understand concepts like network effects and switching costs. If we tried to explain why they should behave the way we predicted, they'd just shake their heads at us, bewildered. We had a mental model for how people use software that was years out of date. And so eventually, painfully, after dozens of meetings like that, it started to dawn on us that the IAM add-on concept was fundamentally flawed. Our customers did not want an IAM add-on. They wanted a standalone IAM network. They did not consider having to learn how to use a new IAM program a barrier. On the contrary, our early adopters used many different IAM programs simultaneously. Our customers were not intimidated by the idea of having to take their friends with them to a new IAM network. It turned out that they enjoyed that challenge. Even more surprising, our assumption that customers would want to use avatar-based IAM primarily with their existing friends was also wrong. They wanted to make new friends, an activity that 3D avatars are particularly well-suited to facilitating. Bit by bit, customers tore apart our seemingly brilliant initial strategy. Throwing my work away. Perhaps you can sympathize with our situation and forgive my obstinacy. After all, it was my work over the prior months that needed to be thrown away. I had slaved over the software that was required to make our IAM program interoperate with other networks, which was at the heart of our original strategy. When it came time to pivot and abandon that original strategy, almost all of my work, thousands of lines of code, was thrown out. I felt betrayed. I was a devotee of the latest in software development methods, known collectively as agile development, which promised to help drive waste out of product development. However, despite that, I had still committed the biggest waste of all, building a product that our customers refused to use. That was really depressing. I wondered, in light of the fact that my work turned out to be a waste of time and energy, would the company have been just as well off if I had spent the last 6 months on a beach sipping umbrella drinks? Had I really been needed? Would it have been better if I had not done any work at all? There is, as I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter, always one last refuge for people aching to justify their own failure. I consoled myself that if we hadn't built this first product, mistakes and all, we never would have learned these important insights about customers. We never would have learned that our strategy was flawed. There is truth in this excuse. What we learned during those critical early months set InView on a path that would lead to our eventual breakout success. For a time, this learning consolation made me feel better. But my relief was short-lived. Here's the question that bothered me most of all. If the goal of those months was to learn these important insights about customers, why did it take so long? How much of our effort contributed to the essential lessons we needed to learn? Could we have learned those lessons earlier if I hadn't been so focused on making the product better by adding features and fixing bugs? Value versus waste. In other words, which of our efforts are value-creating and which are wasteful? This question is at the heart of the lean manufacturing revolution. It is the first question any lean manufacturing adherent is trained to ask. Learning to see waste and then systematically eliminate it has allowed lean companies such as Toyota to dominate entire industries. In the world of software, the agile development methodologies I had practiced until that time had their origins in lean thinking. They were designed to eliminate waste, too. Yet those methods had led me down a road in which the majority of my team's efforts were wasted. Why? The answer came to me slowly over the subsequent years. Lean thinking defines value as providing benefit to the customer. Anything else is waste. In a manufacturing business, customers don't care how the product is assembled, only that it works correctly. But in a startup, who the customer is and what the customer might find valuable are unknown, part of the very uncertainty that is an essential part of the definition of a startup. I realized that, as a startup, we needed a new definition of value. The real progress we had made at InView was what we had learned over those first months about what creates value for customers. Anything we had done during those months that did not contribute to our learning was a form of waste. Would it have been possible to learn the same things with less effort? Clearly, the answer is yes. For one thing, think of all the debate and prioritization of effort that went into features that customers would never discover. If we had shipped sooner, we could have avoided that waste. Also, consider all the waste caused by our incorrect strategic assumptions. I had built interoperability for more than a dozen different IAM clients and networks. Was this really necessary to test our assumptions? Could we have gotten the same feedback from our customers with half as many networks? With only three? With only one? Since the customers of all IAM networks found our product equally unattractive, the level of learning would have been the same, but our effort would have been dramatically less. Here's the thought that kept me up nights. Did we have to support any networks at all? Is it possible that we could have discovered how flawed our assumptions were without building anything? For example, what if we simply had offered customers the opportunity to download the product from us solely on the basis of its proposed features before building anything? Remember, almost no customers were willing to use our original product, so we wouldn't have had to do much apologizing when we failed to deliver. Note that this is different from asking customers what they want. Most of the time, customers don't know what they want in advance. We could have conducted an experiment, offering customers the chance to try something and then measuring their behavior. Such thought experiments were extremely disturbing to me because they undermined my job description. As the head of product development, I thought my job was to ensure the timely delivery of high-quality products and features. But if many of those features were a waste of time, what should I be doing instead? How could we avoid this waste? I've come to believe that learning is the essential unit of progress for startups. The effort that is not absolutely necessary for learning what customers want can be eliminated. I call this validated learning because it is always demonstrated by positive improvements in the startup's core metrics. As we've seen, it's easy to kid yourself about what you think customers want. It's also easy to learn things that are completely irrelevant. Thus, validated learning is backed up by empirical data collected from real customers. Where do you find validation? As I can attest, anyone who fails in a startup can claim that he or she has learned a lot from the experience. They can tell a compelling story. In fact, in the story of ImView so far, you might have noticed something missing. Despite my claims that we learned a lot in those early months, lessons that led to our eventual success, I haven't offered any evidence to back that up. In hindsight, it's easy to make such claims and sound credible. And you'll see some evidence later in the book. But imagine us in ImView's early months trying to convince investors, employees, family members, and most of all ourselves that we had not squandered our time and resources. What evidence did we have? Certainly, our stories of failure were entertaining, and we had fascinating theories about what we had done wrong and what we needed to do to create a more successful product. However, the proof did not come until we put those theories into practice and built subsequent versions of the product that showed superior results with actual customers. The next few months are where the true story of ImView begins. Not with our brilliant assumptions and strategies and whiteboard gamesmanship, but with the hard work of discovering what customers really wanted and adjusting our product and strategy to meet those desires. We adopted the view that our job was to find a synthesis between our vision and what customers would accept. It wasn't to capitulate to what customers thought they wanted or to tell customers what they ought to want. As we came to understand our customers better, we were able to improve our products. As we did that, the fundamental metrics of our business changed. In the early days, despite our efforts to improve the product, our metrics were stubbornly flat. We treated each day's customers as a new report card. We'd pay attention to the percentage of new customers who exhibited product behaviors, such as downloading and buying our product. Each day, roughly the same number of customers would buy the product, and that number was pretty close to zero, despite our many improvements. However, once we pivoted away from the original strategy, things started to change. Aligned with a superior strategy, our product development efforts became magically more productive, not because we were working harder, but because we were working smarter, aligned with our customers' real needs. Positive changes in metrics became the quantitative validation that our learning was real. This was critically important because we could show our stakeholders, employees, investors, and ourselves that we were making genuine progress, not deluding ourselves. It is also the right way to think about productivity in a startup, not in terms of how much stuff we are building, but in terms of how much validated learning we're getting for our efforts. For example, in one early experiment, we changed our entire website, homepage, and product registration flow to replace avatar chat with 3D instant messaging. New customers were split automatically between these two versions of the site. Half saw one and half saw the other. We were able to measure the difference in behavior between the two groups. Not only were the people in the experimental group more likely to sign up for the product, they were more likely to become long-term paying customers. We had plenty of failed experiments, too. During one period in which we believed that customers weren't using the product because they didn't understand its many benefits, we went so far as to pay customer service agents to act as virtual tour guides for new customers. Unfortunately, customers who got that VIP treatment were no more likely to become active or paying customers. Even after ditching the IM add-on strategy, it still took months to understand why it hadn't worked. After our pivot and many failed experiments, we finally figured out this insight. Customers wanted to use InView to make new friends online. Our customers intuitively grasped something that we were slow to realize. All the existing social products online were centered on customers' real-life identity. InView's avatar technology, however, was uniquely well-suited to help people get to know each other online without compromising safety or opening themselves up to identity theft. Once we formed this hypothesis, our experiments became much more likely to produce positive results. Whenever we would change the product to make it easier for people to find and keep new friends, we discovered that customers were more likely to engage. This is true startup productivity, systematically figuring out the right things to build. These were just a few experiments among hundreds that we ran week in and week out as we started to learn which customers would use the product and why. Each bit of knowledge we gathered suggested new experiments to run, which moved our metrics closer and closer to our goal. The audacity of zero. Despite InView's early success, our gross numbers were still pretty small. Unfortunately, because of the traditional way businesses are evaluated, this is a dangerous situation. The irony is that it is often easier to raise money or acquire other resources when you have zero revenue, zero customers, and zero traction than when you have a small amount. Zero invites imagination, but small numbers invite questions about whether large numbers will ever materialize. Everyone knows, or thinks he or she knows, stories of products that achieved breakthrough success overnight. As long as nothing has been released and no data have been collected, it is still possible to imagine overnight success in the future. Small numbers pour cold water on that hope. This phenomenon creates a brutal incentive: postpone getting any data until you are certain of success. Of course, as we'll see, such delays have the unfortunate effect of increasing the amount of wasted work, decreasing essential feedback, and dramatically increasing the risk that a startup will build something nobody wants. However, releasing a product and hoping for the best is not a good plan either, because this incentive is real. When we launched InView, we were ignorant of this problem. Our earliest investors and advisors thought it was quaint that we had a $300 per month revenue plan at first. But after several months, with our revenue hovering around $500 per month, some began to lose faith, as did some of our advisors, employees, and even spouses. In fact, at one point, some investors were seriously recommending that we pull the product out of the market and return to stealth mode. Fortunately, as we pivoted and experimented, incorporating what we learned into our product development and marketing efforts, our numbers started to improve. But not by much. On the one hand, we were lucky to see a growth pattern that started to look like the famous hockey stick graph. On the other hand, the graph went up only to a few thousand dollars per month. These early graphs, although promising, were not by themselves sufficient to combat the loss of faith caused by our early failure, and we lacked the language of validated learning to provide an alternative concept to rally around. We were quite fortunate that some of our early investors understood its importance and were willing to look beyond our small gross numbers to see the real progress we were making. Thus, we can mitigate the waste that happens because of the audacity of zero with validated learning. What we needed to demonstrate was that our product development efforts were leading us towards massive success without giving in to the temptation to fall back on vanity metrics and success theater, the work we do to make ourselves look successful. We could have tried marketing gimmicks, bought a Super Bowl ad, or tried flamboyant public relations, PR, as a way of juicing our gross numbers. That would have given investors the illusion of traction, but only for a short time. Eventually, the fundamentals of the business would win out and the PR bump would pass. Because we would have squandered precious resources on theatrics instead of progress, we would have been in real trouble. 60 million avatars later, ImView is still going strong. Its legacy is not just a great product, an amazing team, and promising financial results, but a whole new way of measuring the progress of startups. Lessons beyond ImView. I have had many opportunities to teach the ImView story as a business case ever since Stanford's Graduate School of Business wrote an official study about ImView's early years. The case is now part of the entrepreneurship curriculum at several business schools, including Harvard Business School, where I serve as an entrepreneur in residence. I've also told these stories at countless workshops, lectures, and conferences. Every time I teach the ImView story, students have an overwhelming temptation to focus on the tactics it illustrates: launching a low-quality early prototype, charging customers from day one, and using low-volume revenue targets as a way to drive accountability. These are useful techniques, but they are not the moral of the story. There are too many exceptions. Not every kind of customer will accept a low-quality prototype, for example. If the students are more skeptical, they may argue that the techniques do not apply to their industry or situation, but only work because ImView is a software company, a consumer internet business, or a non-mission-critical application. None of these takeaways is especially useful. The lean startup is not a collection of individual tactics. It is a principled approach to new product development. The only way to make sense of its recommendations is to understand the underlying principles that make them work. As we'll see in later chapters, the lean startup model has been applied to a wide variety of businesses and industries: manufacturing, clean tech, restaurants, and even laundry. The tactics from the ImView story may or may not make sense in your particular business. Instead, the way forward is to learn to see every startup in any industry as a grand experiment. The question is not, can this product be built? In the modern economy, almost any product that can be imagined can be built. The more pertinent questions are, should this product be built? And can we build a sustainable business around this set of products and services? To answer those questions, we need a method for systematically breaking down a business plan into its component parts and testing each part empirically. In other words, we need the scientific method. In the lean startup model, every product, every feature, every marketing campaign, everything a startup does is understood to be an experiment designed to achieve validated learning. This experimental approach works across industries and sectors, as we'll see in Chapter 4. Chapter 4, Experiment. I come across many startups that are struggling to answer the following questions. Which customer opinions should we listen to, if any? How should we prioritize across the many features we could build? Which features are essential to the product's success and which are ancillary? What can be changed safely and what might anger customers? What might please today's customers at the expense of tomorrow's? What should we work on next? These are some of the questions teams struggle to answer if they have followed the "let's just ship a product and see what happens" plan. I call this the "just do it" school of entrepreneurship after Nike's famous slogan. Unfortunately, if the plan is to see what happens, a team is guaranteed to succeed at seeing what happens, but won't necessarily gain validated learning. This is one of the most important lessons of the scientific method. If you cannot fail, you cannot learn. From alchemy to science. The lean startup methodology reconceives a startup's efforts as experiments that test its strategy to see which parts are brilliant and which are crazy. A true experiment follows the scientific method. It begins with a clear hypothesis that makes predictions about what is supposed to happen. It then tests those predictions empirically. Just as scientific experimentation is informed by theory, startup experimentation is guided by the startup's vision. The goal of every startup experiment is to discover how to build a sustainable business around that vision. Think big, start small. Zappos is the world's largest online shoe store, with annual gross sales in excess of $1 billion. It is known as one of the most successful, customer-friendly e-commerce businesses in the world, but it did not start that way. Founder Nick Swinmurn was frustrated because there was no central online site with a great selection of shoes. He envisioned a new and superior retail experience. Swinmurn could have waited a long time, insisting on testing his complete vision, complete with warehouses, distribution partners, and the promise of significant sales. Many early e-commerce pioneers did just that, including infamous dot-com failures such as Webvan and Pets.com. Instead, he started by running an experiment. His hypothesis was that customers were ready and willing to buy shoes online. To test it, he began by asking local shoe stores if he could take pictures of their inventory. In exchange for permission to take the pictures, he would post the pictures online and come back to buy the shoes at full price if a customer bought them online. Zappos began with a tiny, simple product. It was designed to answer one question above all: is there already sufficient demand for a superior online shopping experience for shoes? However, a well-designed startup experiment, like the one Zappos began with, does more than test a single aspect of a business plan. In the course of testing this first assumption, many other assumptions were tested as well. To sell the shoes, Zappos had to interact with customers, taking payment, handling returns, and dealing with customer support. This is decidedly different from market research. If Zappos had relied on existing market research or conducted a survey, it could have asked what customers thought they wanted. By building a product instead, albeit a simple one, the company learned much more. 1. It had more accurate data about customer demand because it was observing real customer behavior, not asking hypothetical questions. 2. It put itself in a position to interact with real customers and learn about their needs. For example, the business plan might call for discounted pricing, but how are customer perceptions of the product affected by the discounting strategy? 3. It allowed itself to be surprised when customers behaved in unexpected ways, revealing information Zappos might not have known to ask about. For example, what if customers returned the shoes? Zappos' initial experiment provided a clear, quantifiable outcome. Either a sufficient number of customers would buy the shoes, or they would not. It also put the company in a position to observe, interact with, and learn from real customers and partners. This qualitative learning is a necessary companion to quantitative testing. Although the early efforts were decidedly small scale, that did not prevent the huge Zappos vision from being realized. In fact, in 2009, Zappos was acquired by the e-commerce giant Amazon.com for a reported $1.2 billion. For long-term change, experiment immediately. Caroline Barlerin is a director in the Global Social Innovation Division at Hewlett-Packard, HP, a multinational company with more than 300,000 employees and more than $100 billion in annual sales. Caroline, who leads global community involvement, is a social entrepreneur working to get more of HP's employees to take advantage of the company's policy on volunteering. Corporate guidelines encourage every employee to spend up to 4 hours a month of company time volunteering in his or her community. That volunteer work could take the form of any philanthropic effort, painting fences, building houses, or even using pro bono or work-based skills outside the company. Encouraging the latter type of volunteering was Caroline's priority. Because of its talent and values, HP's combined workforce has the potential to have a monumental positive impact. A designer could help a nonprofit with a new website design. A team of engineers could wire a school for internet access. Caroline's project is just beginning, and most employees do not know that this volunteering policy exists, and only a tiny fraction take advantage of it. Most of the volunteering has been of the low-impact variety, involving manual labor, even when the volunteers were highly trained experts. Barlerin's vision is to take the hundreds of thousands of employees in the company and transform them into a force for social good. This is the kind of corporate initiative undertaken every day at companies around the world. It doesn't look like a startup by the conventional definition or what we see in the movies. On the surface, it seems to be suited to traditional management and planning. However, I hope the discussion in Chapter 2 has prompted you to be a little suspicious. Here's how we might analyze this project using the Lean Startup framework. Caroline's project faces extreme uncertainty. There had never been a volunteering campaign of this magnitude at HP before. How confident should she be that she knows the real reasons people aren't volunteering? Most important, how much does she really know about how to change the behavior of hundreds of thousands of people in more than 170 countries? Barlerin's goal is to inspire her colleagues to make the world a better place. Looked at that way, her plan seems full of untested assumptions and a lot of vision. In accordance with traditional management practices, Barlerin is spending time planning, getting buy-in from various departments and other managers, and preparing a roadmap of initiatives for the first 18 months of her project. She also has a strong accountability framework, with metrics for the impact her project should have on the company over the next 4 years. Like many entrepreneurs, she has a business plan that lays out her intentions nicely. Yet despite all that work, she is, so far, creating one-off wins and no closer to knowing if her vision will be able to scale. One assumption, for example, might be that the company's long-standing values included a commitment to improving the community, but that recent economic trouble had resulted in an increased company-wide strategic focus on short-term profitability. Perhaps long-term employees would feel a desire to reaffirm their values of giving back to the community by volunteering. A second assumption could be that they would find it more satisfying and therefore more sustainable to use their actual workplace skills in a volunteer capacity, which would have a greater impact on behalf of the organizations to which they donated their time. Also lurking within Caroline's plans are many practical assumptions about employees' willingness to take the time to volunteer, their level of commitment and desire, and the way to best reach them with her message. The Lean Startup model offers a way to test these hypotheses rigorously, immediately, and thoroughly. Strategic planning takes months to complete. These experiments could begin immediately. By starting small, Caroline could prevent a tremendous amount of waste down the road without compromising her overall vision. Here's what it might look like if Caroline were to treat her project as an experiment. Break it down. The first step would be to break down the grand vision into its component parts. The two most important assumptions entrepreneurs make are what I call the value hypothesis and the growth hypothesis. The value hypothesis tests whether a product or service really delivers value to customers once they are using it. What's a good indicator that employees find donating their time valuable? We could survey them to get their opinion, but that would not be very accurate because most people have a hard time assessing their feelings objectively. Experiments provide a more accurate gauge. What could we see in real time that would serve as a proxy for the value participants were gaining from volunteering? We could find opportunities for a small number of employees to volunteer and then look at the retention rate of those employees. How many of them sign up to volunteer again? When an employee voluntarily invests their time and attention in this program, that is a strong indicator that they find it valuable. For the growth hypothesis, which tests how new customers will discover a product or service, we can do a similar analysis. Once the program is up and running, how will it spread among the employees, from initial early adopters to mass adoption throughout the company? A likely way this program could expand is through viral growth. If that is true, the most important thing to measure is behavior. Would the early participants actively spread the word to other employees? In this case, a simple experiment would involve taking a very small number, a dozen perhaps, of existing long-term employees and providing an exceptional volunteer opportunity for them. Because Caroline's hypothesis was that employees would be motivated by their desire to live up to HP's historical commitment to community service, the experiment would target employees who felt the greatest sense of disconnect between their daily routine and the company's expressed values. The point is not to find the average customer, but to find early adopters, the customers who feel the need for the product most acutely. Those customers tend to be more forgiving of mistakes and are especially eager to give feedback. Next, using a technique I call the concierge minimum viable product, which is described in detail in Chapter 6, Caroline could make sure the first few participants had an experience that was as good as she could make it, completely aligned with her vision. Unlike in a focus group, her goal would be to measure what the customers actually did. For example, how many of the first volunteers actually complete their volunteer assignments? How many volunteer a second time? How many are willing to recruit a colleague to participate in a subsequent volunteer activity? Additional experiments can expand on this early feedback and learning. For example, if the growth model requires that a certain percentage of participants share their experiences with colleagues and encourage their participation, the degree to which that takes place can be tested even with a very small sample of people. If 10 people complete the first experiment, how many do we expect to volunteer again? If they are asked to recruit a colleague, how many do we expect will do so? Remember that these are supposed to be the kinds of early adopters with the most to gain from the program. Put another way, what if all 10 early adopters declined to volunteer again? That would be a highly significant and very negative result. If the numbers from such early experiments don't look promising, there is clearly a problem with the strategy. That doesn't mean it's time to give up. On the contrary, it means it's time to get some immediate qualitative feedback about how to improve the program. Here's where this kind of experimentation has an advantage over traditional market research. We don't have to commission a survey or find new people to interview. We already have a cohort of people to talk to, as well as knowledge about their actual behavior, the participants in the initial experiment. This entire experiment could be conducted in a matter of weeks, less than one-tenth the time of the traditional strategic planning process. Also, it can happen in parallel with strategic planning, while the plan is still being formulated. Even when experiments produce a negative result, those failures prove instructive and can influence the strategy. For example, what if no volunteers can be found who are experiencing the conflict of values within the organization that was such an important assumption in the business plan? If so, congratulations, it's time to pivot, a concept that is explored in more detail in Chapter 8. An experiment is a product. In the Lean Startup model, an experiment is more than just a theoretical inquiry. It is also a first product. If this or any other experiment is successful, it allows the manager to get started with his or her campaign, enlisting early adopters, adding employees to each further experiment or iteration, and eventually starting to build a product. By the time that product is ready to be distributed widely, it will already have established customers. It will have solved real problems and offer detailed specifications for what needs to be built. Unlike a traditional strategic planning or market research process, this specification will be rooted in feedback on what is working today rather than an anticipation of what might work tomorrow. To see this in action, consider an example from Kodak. Kodak's history is bound up with cameras and film, but today it also operates a substantial online business called Kodak Gallery. Mark Cook is Kodak Gallery's Vice President of Products, and he is working to change Kodak Gallery's culture of development to embrace experimentation. Mark explained, "Traditionally, the product manager says, 'I just want this.' In response, the engineer says, 'I'm going to build it.' Instead, I try to push my team to first answer four questions. 1. Do consumers recognize that they have the problem you are trying to solve? 2. If there was a solution, would they buy it? 3. Would they buy it from us? And 4. Can we build a solution for that problem?" The common tendency of product development is to skip straight to the fourth question and build a solution before confirming that customers have the problem. For example, Kodak Gallery offered wedding cards with gilded text and graphics on its site. Those designs were popular with customers who were getting married, and so the team redesigned the cards to be used at other special occasions, such as for holidays. The market research and design process indicated that customers would like the new cards, and that finding justified the significant effort that went into creating them. Days before the launch, the team realized the cards were too difficult to understand from their depiction on the website. People couldn't see how beautiful they were. They were also hard to produce. Cook realized that they had done the work backward. He explained, "Until we could figure out how to sell and make the product, it wasn't worth spending any engineering time on." Learning from that experience, Cook took a different approach when he led his team through the development of a new set of features for a product that makes it easier to share photos taken at an event. They believed that an online event album would provide a way for people who attended a wedding, a conference, or another gathering to share photos with other attendees. Unlike other online photo sharing services, Kodak Gallery's event album would have strong privacy controls, assuring that the photos would be shared only with people who attended the same event. In a break with the past, Cook led the group through a process of identifying risks and assumptions before building anything, and then testing those assumptions experimentally. There were two main hypotheses underlying the proposed event album. 1. The team assumed that customers would want to create the albums in the first place. 2. It assumed that event participants would upload photos to event albums created by friends or colleagues. The Kodak Gallery team built a simple prototype of the event album. It lacked many features, so many, in fact, that the team was reluctant to show it to customers. However, even at that early stage, allowing customers to use the prototype helped the team refute their hypotheses. First, creating an album was not as easy as the team had predicted. None of the early customers were able to create one. Further, customers complained that the early product version lacked essential features. Those negative results demoralized the team. The usability problems frustrated them, as did customer complaints about missing features, many of which matched the original roadmap. Cook explained that even though the product was missing features, the project was not a failure. The initial product, flaws and all, confirmed that users did have the desire to create event albums, which was extremely valuable information. Where customers complained about missing features, this suggested that the team was on the right track. The team now had early evidence that those features were, in fact, important. What about features that were on the roadmap but that customers didn't complain about? Maybe those features weren't as important as they initially seemed. Through a beta launch, the team continued to learn and iterate. While the early users were enthusiastic and the numbers were promising, the team made a major discovery. Through the use of online surveying tool Kiss Insights, the team learned that many customers wanted to be able to arrange the order of pictures before they would invite others to contribute. Knowing they weren't ready to launch, Cook held off his division's general manager by explaining how iterating and experimenting before beginning the marketing campaign would yield far better results. In a world where marketing launch dates were often set months in advance, waiting until the team had really solved the problem was a break from the past. This process represented a dramatic change for Kodak Gallery. employees were used to being measured on their progress at completing tasks. As Cook says, success is not delivering a feature. Success is learning how to solve the customer's problem. The Village Laundry Service. In India, due to the cost of a washing machine, less than 7% of the population have one in their homes. Most people either hand wash their clothing at home or pay a dhobi to do it for them. Dhobis take the clothes to the nearest river, wash them in the river water, bang them against rocks to get them clean, and hang them to dry, which takes 2 to 7 days. The result? Clothes are returned in about 10 days and are probably not that clean. Akshay Mehra had been working at Procter & Gamble Singapore for 8 years when he sensed an opportunity. As the regional brand manager of the Tide and Pantene brands, he thought he could make laundry services available to people who previously could not afford them. Returning to India, Akshay joined the Village Laundry Services, VLS, created by Innosight Ventures. VLS began a series of experiments to test its business assumptions. For their first experiment, VLS mounted a consumer-grade laundry machine on the back of a pickup truck parked on a street corner in Bangalore. The experiment cost less than $8,000 and had the simple goal of proving that people would hand over their laundry and pay to have it cleaned. The entrepreneurs did not clean the laundry on the truck, which was more for marketing and show, but took it off-site to be cleaned and brought it back to their customers by the end of the day. The VLS team continued the experiment for a week, parking the truck on different street corners, digging deeper to discover all they could about their potential customers. They wanted to know how they could encourage people to come to the truck. Did cleaning speed matter? Was cleanliness a concern? What were people asking for when they left their laundry with them? They discovered that customers were happy to give them their laundry to clean. However, those customers were suspicious of the washing machine mounted on the back of the truck, concerned that VLS would take their laundry and run. To address that concern, VLS created a slightly more substantial mobile cart that looked more like a kiosk. VLS also experimented with parking the carts in front of a local mini market chain. Further iterations helped VLS figure out which services people were most interested in and what price they were willing to pay. They discovered that customers often wanted their clothes ironed and were willing to pay double the price to get their laundry back in 4 hours rather than 24 hours. As a result of those early experiments, VLS created an end product that was a 3-foot by 4-foot mobile kiosk that included an energy-efficient consumer-grade washing machine, a dryer, and an extra-long extension cord. The kiosk used Western detergents and was supplied daily with fresh, clean water delivered by VLS. Since then, the Village Laundry Service has grown substantially, with 14 locations operational in Bangalore, Mysore, and Mumbai. As CEO Akshay Mehra shared with me, we have serviced 116,000 kilograms in 2010 versus 30,600 kilograms in 2009. And almost 60% of the business is coming from repeat customers. We have serviced more than 10,000 customers in the past year alone across all the outlets. A lean startup in government? On July 21, 2010, President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act into law. One of its landmark provisions created a new federal agency, the Consumer Federal Protection Bureau, CFPB. This agency is tasked with protecting American citizens from predatory lending by financial services companies, such as credit card companies, student lenders, and payday loan offices. The plan calls for it to accomplish this by setting up a call center where trained caseworkers will field calls directly from the public. Left to its own devices, a new government agency would probably hire a large staff with a large budget to develop a plan that is expensive and time-consuming. However, the CFPB is considering doing things differently. Despite its $500 million budget and high-profile origins, the CFPB is really a startup. President Obama tasked his chief technology officer, Anish Chopra, with collecting ideas for how to set up the new startup agency, and that is how I came to be involved. On one of Chopra's visits to Silicon Valley, He invited a number of entrepreneurs to make suggestions for ways to cultivate a startup mentality in the new agency. In particular, his focus was on leveraging technology and innovation to make the agency more efficient, cost-effective, and thorough. My suggestion was drawn straight from the principles of this chapter. Treat the CFPB as an experiment. Identify the elements of the plan that are assumptions rather than facts, and figure out ways to test them. Using these insights, we could build a minimum viable product and have the agency up and running on a micro scale long before the official plan was set in motion. The number one assumption underlying the current plan is that once Americans know they can call the CFPB for help with financial fraud and abuse, there will be a significant volume of citizens who do that. This sounds reasonable, as it is based on market research about the amount of fraud that affects Americans each year. However, despite all that research, it is still an assumption. If the actual call volume differs markedly from that in the plan, it will require significant revision. What if Americans who are subjected to financial abuse don't view themselves as victims and therefore don't seek help? What if they have very different notions of what problems are important? What if they call the agency seeking help for problems that are outside its purview? Once the agency is up and running with a $500 million budget and a correspondingly large staff, altering the plan will be expensive and time-consuming. But why wait to get feedback? To start experimenting immediately, the agency could start with the creation of a simple hotline number using one of the new breed of low-cost and fast-setup platforms such as Twilio. With a few hours' work, they could add simple voice prompts, offering callers a menu of financial problems to choose from. In the first version, the prompts could be drawn straight from the existing research. Instead of a caseworker on the line, each prompt could offer the caller useful information about how to solve his or her problem. Instead of marketing this hotline to the whole country, the agency could run the experiment in a much more limited way. Start with a small geographic area, perhaps as small as a few city blocks. And instead of paying for expensive television or radio advertising to let people know about the service, use highly targeted advertising, flyers on billboards, newspaper advertisements to those blocks, or specially targeted online ads would be a good start. Since the target area is so small, they could afford to pay a premium to create a high-level awareness in the target zone. The total cost would remain quite small. As a comprehensive solution to the problem of financial abuse, this minimum viable product is not very good compared with what a $500 million agency could accomplish. But it is also not very expensive. This product could be built in a matter of days or weeks, and the whole experiment probably would cost only a few thousand dollars. What we would learn from this experiment would be invaluable. On the basis of the selections of those first callers, the agency could immediately start to get a sense of what kinds of problems Americans believe they have, not just what they should have. The agency could begin to test marketing messages. What motivates people to call? It could start to extrapolate real-world trends. What percentage of people in the target area actually call? The extrapolation would not be perfect, but it would establish a baseline behavior that would be far more accurate than market research. Most important, this product would serve as a seed that could germinate into a much more elaborate service. With this beginning, the agency could engage in a continuous process of improvement, slowly but surely adding more and better solutions. Eventually, it would staff the hotline with caseworkers, perhaps at first addressing only one category of problems, to give the caseworkers the best chance of success. By the time the official plan was ready for implementation, this early service could serve as a real-world template. The CFPB is just getting started, but already they are showing signs of following an experimental approach. For example, instead of doing a geographically limited rollout, they are segmenting their first products by use case. They have established a preliminary order of financial products to provide consumer services for, with credit cards coming first. As their first experiment unfolds, they will have the opportunity to closely monitor all of the other complaints and consumer feedback they receive. This data will influence the depth, breadth, and sequence of future offerings. As David Forrest, the CFPB's chief technology officer, told me, Our goal is to give American citizens an easy way to tell us about the problems they see out there in the consumer financial marketplace. We have an opportunity to closely monitor what the public is telling us and react to new information. Markets change all the time, and our job is to change with them. The entrepreneurs and managers profiled in this book are smart, capable, and extremely results-oriented. In many cases, they are in the midst of building an organization in a way consistent with the best practices of current management thinking. They face the same challenges in both the public and private sectors, regardless of industry. As we've seen, even the seasoned managers and executives at the world's best-run companies struggle to consistently develop and launch innovative new products. Their challenge is to overcome the prevailing management thinking that puts its faith in well-researched plans. Remember, planning is a tool that only works in the presence of a long and stable operating history. And yet, do any of us feel that the world around us is getting more and more stable every day? Changing such a mindset is hard but critical to startup success. My hope is that this book will help managers and entrepreneurs make this change. Part 2. Steer. How vision leads to steering. At its heart, a startup is a catalyst that transforms ideas into products. As customers interact with those products, they generate feedback and data. The feedback is both qualitative, such as what they like and don't like, and quantitative, such as how many people use it and find it valuable. As we saw in Part 1, the products a startup builds are really experiments. The learning about how to build a sustainable business is the outcome of those experiments. For startups, that information is much more important than dollars, awards, or mentions in the press, because it can influence and reshape the next set of ideas. This build, measure, learn feedback loop is at the core of the Lean Startup model. In Part 2, we will examine it in great detail. Many people have professional training that emphasizes one element of this feedback loop. For engineers, it's learning to build things as efficiently as possible. Some managers are experts at strategizing and learning at the whiteboard. Plenty of entrepreneurs focus their energies on the individual nouns, having the best product idea or the best designed initial product, or obsessing over data and metrics. The truth is that none of these activities by itself is of paramount importance. Instead, we need to focus our energies on minimizing the total time through this feedback loop. This is the essence of steering a startup and is the subject of Part 2. We will walk through a complete turn of the build, measure, learn feedback loop, discussing each of the components in detail. The purpose of Part 1 was to explore the importance of learning as the measure of progress for a startup. As I hope is evident by now, by focusing our energies on validated learning, we can avoid much of the waste that plagues startups today. As in lean manufacturing, learning where and when to invest energy results in saving time and money. To apply the scientific method to a startup, we need to identify which hypotheses to test. I call the riskiest elements of a startup's plan, the parts on which everything depends, leap of faith assumptions. The two most important assumptions are the value hypothesis and the growth hypothesis. These give rise to tuning variables that control a startup's engine of growth. Each iteration of a startup is an attempt to rev this engine to see if it will turn. Once it is running, the process repeats, shifting into higher and higher gears. Once clear on these leap-of-faith assumptions, the first step is to enter the build phase as quickly as possible with a minimum viable product, MVP. The MVP is that version of the product that enables a full turn of the build-measure-learn loop with a minimum amount of effort and the least amount of development time. The minimum viable product lacks many features that may prove essential later on. However, in some ways, creating an MVP requires extra work. We must be able to measure its impact. For example, It is inadequate to build a prototype that is evaluated solely for internal quality by engineers and designers. We also need to get it in front of potential customers to gauge their reactions. We may even need to try selling them the prototype, as we'll soon see. When we enter the measure phase, the biggest challenge will be determining whether the product development efforts are leading to real progress. Remember, if we're building something that nobody wants, it doesn't much matter if we're doing it on time and on budget. The method I recommend is called innovation accounting, a quantitative approach that allows us to see whether our engine tuning efforts are bearing fruit. It also allows us to create learning milestones, which are an alternative to traditional business and product milestones. Learning milestones are useful for entrepreneurs as a way of assessing their progress accurately and objectively. They are also invaluable to managers and investors who must hold entrepreneurs accountable. However, not all metrics are created equal, and in Chapter 7, I'll clarify the danger of vanity metrics in contrast to the nuts and bolts usefulness of actionable metrics, which help to analyze customer behavior in ways that support innovation accounting. Finally, and most important, there's the pivot. Upon completing the build, measure, learn loop, we confront the most difficult question any entrepreneur faces, whether to pivot the original strategy or persevere. If we've discovered that one of our hypotheses is false, it is time to make a major change to a new strategic hypothesis. The Lean Startup Method builds capital-efficient companies because it allows startups to recognize that it's time to pivot sooner, creating less waste of time and money. Although we write the feedback loop as build, measure, learn, because the activities happen in that order, our planning really works in the reverse order. We figure out what we need to learn, use innovation accounting to figure out what we need to measure to know if we are gaining validated learning, and then figure out what product we need to build to run that experiment and get that measurement. All of the techniques in Part 2 are designed to minimize the total time through the build, measure, learn feedback loop. Chapter 5, Leap. In 2004, three college sophomores arrived in Silicon Valley with their fledgling college social network. It was live on a handful of college campuses. It was not the market-leading social network, or even the first college social network. Other companies had launched sooner and with more features. With 150,000 registered users, it made very little revenue. Yet that summer, they raised their first $500,000 in venture capital. Less than a year later, they raised an additional $12.7 million. Of course, by now you've guessed that these three college sophomores were Mark Zuckerberg, Dustin Moskovitz, and Chris Hughes of Facebook. Their story is now world famous. Many things about it are remarkable, but I'd like to focus on only one: how Facebook was able to raise so much money when its actual usage was so small. By all accounts, what impressed investors the most were two facts about Facebook's early growth. The first fact was the raw amount of time Facebook's active users spent on the site. More than half of the users came back to the site every single day. This is an example of how a company can validate its value hypothesis, that customers find the product valuable. The second impressive thing about Facebook's early traction was the rate at which it had taken over its first few college campuses. The rate of growth was staggering. Facebook launched on February 4th, 2004, and by the end of that month, almost three-quarters of Harvard's undergraduates were using it, without a dollar of marketing or advertising having been spent. In other words, Facebook also had validated its growth hypothesis. These two hypotheses represent two of the most important leap-of-faith questions any new startup faces. At the time, I heard many people criticize Facebook's early investors, claiming that Facebook had no business model and only modest revenues relative to the valuation offered by its investors. They saw in Facebook a return to the excesses of the dot-com era, when companies with little revenue raised massive amounts of cash to pursue a strategy of attracting eyeballs and getting big fast. many dot-com era startups planned to make money later by selling the eyeballs that they had bought to other advertisers. In truth, those dot-com failures were little more than middlemen, effectively paying money to acquire customers' attention and then planning to resell it to others. Facebook was different because it employed a different engine of growth. It paid nothing for customer acquisition, and its high engagement meant that it was accumulating massive amounts of customer attention every day. There was never any question that attention would be valuable to advertisers. The only question was how much they would pay. Many entrepreneurs are attempting to build the next Facebook. Yet when they try to apply the lessons of Facebook and other famous startup success stories, they quickly get confused. Is the lesson of Facebook that startups should not charge customers money in the early days? Or is it that startups should never spend money on marketing? These questions cannot be answered in the abstract. There are an almost infinite number of counterexamples for any technique. Instead, as we saw in part one, startups need to conduct experiments that help determine what techniques will work in their unique circumstances. For startups, the role of strategy is to help figure out the right questions to ask. Strategy is based on assumptions. Every business plan begins with a set of assumptions. It lays out a strategy that takes those assumptions as a given and proceeds to show how to achieve the company's vision. Because the assumptions haven't been proved to be true, they are assumptions after all, and in fact are often erroneous, the goal of a startup's early efforts should be to test them as quickly as possible. What traditional business strategy excels at is helping managers identify clearly what assumptions are being made in a particular business. The first challenge for an entrepreneur is to build an organization that can test these assumptions systematically. The second challenge, as in all entrepreneurial situations, is to perform that rigorous testing without losing sight of the company's overall vision. Many assumptions in a typical business plan are unexceptional. These are well-established facts drawn from past industry experience or straightforward deductions. In Facebook's case, it was clear that advertisers would pay for customers' attention. Hidden among these mundane details are a handful of assumptions that require more courage to state, in the present tense, with a straight face. We assume that customers have a significant desire to use a product like ours, or we assume that supermarkets will carry our product. Acting as if these assumptions are true is a classic entrepreneur superpower. They are called leaps of faith precisely because the success of the entire venture rests on them. If they are true, tremendous opportunity awaits. If they are false, the startup risks total failure. Most leaps of faith take the form of an argument by analogy. For example, one business plan I remember argued as follows. Just as the development of progressive image loading allowed the widespread use of the World Wide Web over dial-up, so too our progressive rendering technology will allow our product to run on low-end personal computers. You probably have no idea what progressive image loading or rendering is, and it doesn't much matter. But you know the argument. Perhaps you've even used it. Previous technology X was used to win market Y because of attribute Z. We have a new technology, X2, that will enable us to win market Y2 because we too have attribute Z. The problem with analogies like this is that they obscure the true leap of faith. That is their goal, to make the business seem less risky. They are used to persuade investors, employees, or partners to sign on. Most entrepreneurs would cringe to see their leap of faith written this way. Large numbers of people already wanted access to the World Wide Web. They knew what it was, they could afford it, but they could not get access to it because the time it took to load images was too long. When progressive image loading was introduced, it allowed people to get onto the World Wide Web and tell their friends about it. Thus, Company X won Market Y. Similarly, there is already a large number of potential customers who want access to our product right now. They know they want it, they can afford it, but they cannot access it because the rendering is too slow. When we debut our product with progressive rendering technology, they will flock to our software and tell their friends, and we will win market Y too. There are several things to notice in this revised statement. First, it's important to identify the facts clearly. Is it really true that progressive image loading caused the adoption of the World Wide Web, or was this just one factor among many? More important, is it really true that there are large numbers of potential customers out there who want our solution right now? The earlier analogy was designed to convince stakeholders that a reasonable first step is to build the new startup's technology and see if customers will use it. The restated approach should make clear that what is needed is to do some empirical testing first. Let's make sure that there really are hungry customers out there eager to embrace our new technology. Analogs and antilogs. There is nothing intrinsically wrong with basing strategy on comparisons to other companies and industries. In fact, that approach can help you discover assumptions that are not really leaps of faith. For example, the venture capitalist Randy Komisar, whose book Getting to Plan B discussed the concept of leaps of faith in great detail, uses a framework of analogs and antilogs to plot strategy. He explains the analog-antilog concept by using the iPod as an example. If you were looking for analogs, you would have to look at the Walkman, he says. It solved a critical question that Steve Jobs never had to ask himself. Will people listen to music in a public place using earphones? We think of that as a nonsense question today, but it is fundamental. When Sony asked the question, they did not have the answer. Steve Jobs had the answer in the analog version. Sony's Walkman was the analog. Jobs then had to face the fact that although people were willing to download music, they were not willing to pay for it. Napster was an antilog. That antilog had to lead him to address his business in a particular way, Komisar says. Out of these analogs and antilogs comes a series of unique, unanswered questions. Those are leaps of faith that I, as an entrepreneur, am taking if I go through with this business venture. They are going to make or break my business. In the iPod business, one of those leaps of faith was that people would pay for music. Of course, that leap of faith turned out to be correct. Beyond the right place at the right time. There are any number of famous entrepreneurs who made millions because they seemed to be in the right place at the right time. However, for every successful entrepreneur who was in the right place at the right time, there are many more who were there too, in that right place at the right time, but still managed to fail. Henry Ford was joined by nearly 500 other entrepreneurs in the early 20th century. Imagine being an automobile entrepreneur, trained in state-of-the-art engineering, on the ground floor of one of the biggest market opportunities in history. Yet the vast majority managed to make no money at all. We saw the same phenomenon with Facebook, which faced early competition from other college-based social networks whose head start proved irrelevant. What differentiates the success stories from the failures is that the successful entrepreneurs had the foresight, the ability, and the tools to discover which parts of their plans were working brilliantly and which were misguided, and adapt their strategies accordingly. Value and growth. As we saw in the Facebook story, two leaps of faith stand above all others, the value creation hypothesis and the growth hypothesis. The first step in understanding a new product or service is to figure out if it is fundamentally value creating or value destroying. I use the language of economics in referring to value rather than profit, because entrepreneurs include people who start not-for-profit social ventures, those in public sector startups, and internal change agents who do not judge their success by profit alone. Even more confusing, there are many organizations that are wildly profitable in the short term, but ultimately value-destroying, such as the organizers of Ponzi schemes and fraudulent or misguided companies, for example, Enron and Lehman Brothers. A similar thing is true for growth. As with value, it's essential that entrepreneurs understand the reasons behind a startup's growth. There are many value-destroying kinds of growth that should be avoided. An example would be a business that grows through continuous fundraising from investors and lots of paid advertising, but does not develop a value-creating product. Such businesses are engaged in what I call success theater. using the appearance of growth to make it seem that they are successful. One of the goals of innovation accounting, which is discussed in depth in Chapter 7, is to help differentiate these false startups from true innovators. Traditional accounting judges new ventures by the same standards it uses for established companies, but these indications are not reliable predictors of a startup's future prospects. Consider companies such as Amazon.com that racked up huge losses on their way to breakthrough success. Like its traditional counterpart, innovation accounting requires that a startup have and maintain a quantitative financial model that can be used to evaluate progress rigorously. However, in a startup's earliest days, there is not enough data to make an informed guess about what this model might look like. A startup's earliest strategic plans are likely to be hunch or intuition guided, and that is a good thing. To translate those instincts into data, entrepreneurs must, in Steve Blank's famous phrase, get out of the building and start learning.